I'm very happy to welcome Seth Lloyd. He is professor of quantum mechanical engineering at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's an external professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and he's here to talk to us about time travel. He'll be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe on the subject, Is Time Travel Possible? Testing the Grandfather Paradox. It's a free event sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Marichala. It's great to be here.
So, first of all, let's talk for a moment about the Grandfather Paradox, which is something that's often talked about with respect to time travel. What is that paradox?
So, time travel is weird and paradoxical no matter what. Because if you can go back and change the past, then what happens? So in the Grandfather Paradox, the time traveler returns to the past, and accidentally or on purpose, she manages to kill her grandfather when he is a young man, before he has any children. So her parents don't exist and she doesn't exist, so how can she go back in the past to kill her grandfather? It doesn't make sense. It's paradoxical.
And so that is the paradox, and we've all dealt with it because we've all watched fantasy movies or South Park or science fiction or Supernatural or whatever, and thought about this to a greater or lesser extent. But what are the resolutions, theoretically, to the grandfather paradox?
Well, it's important to worry about the grandfather paradox because actually time travel seems to be possible, at least according to the laws of physics. So Einstein's theory of general relativity, which deals with the way that space and time can warp around each other, actually allows time to warp around so that one could, in principle, travel back to the past in what's called a closed time-like curve. And then what happens if you meet your grandfather? My suggestion is, you know, buy him a beer. Be careful.
Right. But at the same time, I mean, if you theoretically were to travel to the past, doesn't the theory of, I don't know, you can tell us what the theory is, tell us that if you change so much as a leaf or a conversation or whatever, the entire future could be different or a big chunk of it?
So if you read human literature about time travel, there are two basic kinds of ways of dealing with this paradox. So there are hundreds or thousands of stories about time travel dating back thousands of years by now. In one of these kind of stories, resolution of the grandfather paradox, if you go back in the past and you kill your grandfather, accidentally or on purpose, then you enter into a parallel universe, an alternative reality where the future is different from the one that you remember. So examples of time travel stories like this are things like stories like Back to the Future, for instance, where when you go back into the past, you change it and all of a sudden you enter into a different future. Maybe a better one, I'm not sure. There are lots of, this is the most common kind of time travel narrative.
Or the atheist episode of South Park.
I'm sorry, I haven't seen the atheist episode of South Park. I tried to look at all these time travel movies and read these books, but in the end I got burned out.
Yeah, I'm sure people are telling you about new ones every day.
Well, it was like there was the Twilight Zone one where Hitler needs an army and he goes back and goes back thousands of times, so he has 1,000 foot soldiers. But the ones who have been back about 1,000 times, they're looking a little worse for wear in the end. Yeah, there are many different kinds of time travel narratives, and so one possibility is that you go back and change the past, and you enter into an alternative future. There's a second kind of time travel story, however. Maybe the most famous example of this is Harry Potter 3, Prisoner of Azkaban. Also the great Terry Gilliam movie, 12 Monkeys, where you go back into the past, and you try to change the past, but no matter how hard you try, you fail. In fact, typically, you bring into being the very thing that you were trying to prevent from happening in the past. So,
well, hang on a second. Yeah. You bring into being the very thing that you were trying to prevent. That means that you do have some agency over the past.
You have agency, but you don't have agency actually to change the things that you remember. So you can make all kinds of weird stuff happen. So, you know, In Prisoner of Azkaban, Harry Potter and his wizarding buddies are messing around Hogwarts, and all kinds of weird stuff is happening. And they can't figure out what the heck is going on. And after a while, they figure out that what's happening is that they themselves are coming back from the future and messing around with the past and making all kinds of strange things happen. But, you know, the second time around, when they live through it the second time around, they realize, oh, I did this, which was what I experienced in the past, and hence this weird thing occurred. So those are two actually completely different kinds of human time travel narratives. And the physical theories, the actual physics of what can happen in time travel, reflects these two different possibilities.
So when you talk about the idea that time travel is theoretically possible, what does that mean? I mean, nobody's ever done it. There's no time machines. He's raising his eyebrows suggestively.
How do you know? In fact, I have, at least in the New Mexican and now here on the air, I'm going to invite any time travelers who happen to be stopping back at this moment of the past to come around to the lecture this evening and make themselves known, or at least have a few brief chuckles on our behalf.
Have any of them done that in past lectures?
No, I haven't had any of them show up or at least make themselves known. There seems to be a conspiracy of silence amongst time travelers.
No, but really, I mean, what are the conditions under which a person could relocate to a different time?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, so Einstein's theory of general relativity says that if you have a gigantic mass of swirling cloud of dust, that it will form these so-called closed time-like curves. Let's say you're traveling on your spaceship, you enter this funny-looking region of space and time, and then you're traveling, and then all of a sudden you see this spaceship in front of you. And the spaceship is your spaceship as it's about to enter into this closed time-like curve. So in principle, it's allowed by the laws of physics for you to go around such a closed time-like curve, emerge in the past, and meet up with your former self. And then what happens?
Now, it's not like you have to travel faster than the speed of light or something like that.
Well, in principle, if you can travel backwards in time, you're traveling faster than the speed of light, according to somebody. And conversely, if you can travel faster than the speed of light, every grade school child I know actually knows that if you can travel faster than the speed of light, you can travel backwards in time. So the two seem to go together. But under the proper circumstances, it seems as this might very well be able to happen.
It sounds like it might not be that good for you.
Yes, I would suggest if somebody, including me, builds a time machine, do not volunteer to be the first person to step into it.
Now, on a physical level, I mean, we introduced you as a professor of quantum mechanical engineering. What kind of experiments, what kind of work do you do to test or think about these theories about time?
So in my day job, and believe me, I'm not giving up my day job to work on time travel because that would be a bad idea. But in my day job, I build quantum computers where you store bits of information on individual atoms and elementary particles, and quantum communication systems. And one of the phenomena that is well demonstrated in quantum communication is teleportation. So in quantum teleportation, you dematerialize something over here and you rematerialize it over there. Now,
and when you say something, are you talking about a gerbil, a photon?
Well, again, I would only recommend my neighbor's gerbil for this procedure. But yeah, so the things that people have teleported are things like photons, rubidium atoms, that kind of thing. We're not at the gerbil stage yet.
Right.
I don't know. I dread to think where we will go. But I mean, at the moment, we're far away from teleporting anything close to a human being.
At the same time, the fact that you can teleport anything at all, first of all, what does that actually mean to teleport something? I mean, what are we looking at? You put something that was originally on one side of the room and in a closed container and say Shazam, and it's on the other side of the room?
Yeah, basically. You're right on top of it. Shazam is the magic scientific word for this. So You have a teleporter, so you take the thing that you want to teleport, let's say rubidium atom, you put it in the teleporter, and meanwhile you've prepared a funky quantum mechanical state called an entangled state with another atom that's across the room. And then you do a measurement which essentially destroys the rubidium atom, and then you send a signal to the far end of the room which allows you to recreate the rubidium atom at the far end of the room. So in ordinary teleportation, you destroy something here, you send some information over there, and then the net result is that the thing that you destroyed dematerialized over here rematerializes over there.
And, I mean, I don't know if this is a physical question or a philosophical question, but is it the same atom?
So since all rubidium atoms are the same, exactly the same, the only thing you can vary is the internal state of the rubidium atom, the configuration of its electrons and magnetic electromagnetic fields. So what ends up being teleported is you start with a rubidium atom over here with some unique signature of its internal state, of its electrons and electromagnetic fields, and then at the end of the day, the rubidium atom with exactly the same internal state, internal configuration of the electromagnetic fields and electrons is over there. So it's absolutely indistinguishable from the original one. Identical, completely identical.
Is there normally any variation among rubidium atoms?
Yeah, the only variation is in its isotope, so the isotopic number, and then how you've prepared this internal state of the rubidium atom.
So what does all this tell you?
What does it tell us? Do you mean teleportation?
Yeah.
It tells us first that teleportation is actually possible, which is kind of interesting, because for a long time people thought it wasn't possible, because in quantum mechanics, when you make a measurement on something, you mess it up. That's a technical term. And then having messed it up, then you couldn't possibly reproduce it just from the information you've gotten. But it turns out with this funky feature called entanglement, you can actually make a measurement over here, completely mess up the rubidium atom over here, but then send information that allows you to recreate the rubidium atom over there. So that's teleportation.
Which is, space is not time.
Space, that's true. Space is not time, but they're kind of like each other.
I'm sorry.
Space is not time, but time and space are kind of interwoven with each other. So there you teleport. Normal teleportation works teleporting something in space to a different place in space to a later time, because you have to send a signal in order to send the thing to this later time. But in time travel, so in the quantum mechanics of time travel, what happens is that you can dematerialize the thing here, and without actually sending a signal, you can have it rematerialize in the past. And this is actually allowed in the presence of things like black holes and these closed time-like curves.
Now, it would be hard to test that.
Well, that's true. When we asked permission at MIT to have a couple of black holes in the laboratory so we could create a little time machine, the workplace safety people objected and they said we weren't allowed to do it. The fools standing in the way of science. Oh, sorry. I went into my mad scientist mode there for a second.
Let us send this thing to last year's graduate students.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. Well, let's hope they don't send the answers to the exams. That's all I can say. But in fact, because our theory is based on teleportation, and because teleportation is something we can do, we actually are able to perform a series of experiments that are, if you like, the moral equivalent of time travel. And it's spookily close to what you would actually get if you actually had a real huge rotating cloud of dust or a black hole and were able to go into the past. The only difference is that rather than being able to teleport something to the past with certainty, we can only do it probabilistically. So we have some chance, say 1 1/4, of teleporting our particle to the past.
It's a funny thing to contemplate, because it seems like the, again, to an outsider like me and perhaps like our listeners, it seems like the borderline between science and science fiction could be a little blurry, and maybe science fiction is informing the questions?
Mary Charlotte, I bet you know. I'm sure you know that you know many times science fiction precedes the actual science.
Right.
So the concepts that people have of doing things like traveling to the moon, for instance, or traveling to the past, this often happens much sooner than what happened than actual science, because people are very imaginative, and all that science is really the expression of our imaginations, albeit with cool math and gizmos.
And repeatability and things
like that. Oh, right, repeatability and things like that. That's right.
Are there any non-Western models of time, like indigenous or Asian or whatever, that in any way resemble the things that you're looking at?
Some Hindu notions of time are that time is cyclical, for instance, and that it repeats over the cycle of many, many eons. The earliest time travel story I've been able to find is from the Mahabharata, the Hindu epic from 2,000 years ago, in which a king goes to visit Brahma in his palace in the sky over the weekend. And when he returns after a zesty time, he finds that countless ages have passed and everybody he knows, including his own kingdom, have fallen into dust. There's a very nice version of this in Japanese legend as well. There is a fisherman named Urashima Taro frees a sea turtle from a net, and a few days later, a kind of turtly-looking, beautiful woman comes and invites him to go and party at the palace of the king under the sea, which he does. Spends a few days there. They fall in love. They marry. They have children. Turns out, of course, she was the turtle whom he found. And then he insists on going back home to his island. She tells him not to do this. He says, I must go. She says, you really shouldn't do it. He says, I'm going to go. She says, okay, don't tell me I didn't warn you. She gives him a beautiful box and says, whatever you do, don't open the box. He goes back to the island. Hundreds of years have passed. Everybody he knows is dead. And so then what do you think he does?
Let me guess. He opens the box?
Like a fool. He opens the box. A white mist comes out, envelops him, and he turns into an old man, and he dies.
Right.
So there are lots of stories from other cultures. But the idea of going backwards in time really didn't show up until H.G. Wells' story, The Time Machine.
Is that right?
Yeah. So the idea of having a machine where you can send things backwards in time didn't show up until the end of the 19th century. And actually our device, the experiment that we did to instantiate the grandfather paradox, is really a quantum mechanical version of this time machine. So you have a little container over here. You have, this photon that you wish to send backwards in time. And the idea of the time machine is you go into the machine, you dial up when you want to go. You press a button, bleep, the red light goes on. And when the red light goes on, it means you've gone into the past or into the future. So in an experiment, what we do is we try to do an instantiation of this grandfather paradox. So we put a photon in the box, we press a button, bleep, if the red light goes on, then the photon has gone backwards in the past, and we set up the experiment so if the photon manages to get back in the past, it tries to kill its former self. That is a simple version of the grandfather paradox. That's what we did. Luckily, there's no Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Photons, at least yet.
Yeah, and there's enough to go around, I suppose.
There are a lot of them. There are a lot of them. In fact, sunblock is a big killer of photons. So.
We're talking to Seth Lloyd, professor of quantum mechanical engineering at MIT. Now, you build quantum computers, whereas you say data is stored on atoms.
Atoms, elementary particles, photons, superconducting systems.
And they work?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Quantum computers are very effective right now.
And what is their advantage over the other kind of computer?
So, in quantum mechanics, in an ordinary classical bit, could be electron here, you could call that zero, an electron over there, you call that one. But in a quantum bit, electrons have this funny feature that they can be here and there at the same time. And because of that, a quantum bit or qubit can store 0 and 1 simultaneously. And as a result, a quantum computer, if you give that quantum bit or qubit as an instruction to a quantum computer, it means that the quantum computer can do two things at once, or four things at once, or eight things at once, or a gajillion things at once. This is a technical term. So quantum computers can do this kind of funky quantum multitasking. Some people even say that they do all these computations simultaneously in parallel universes, which I guess is one way of describing it.
It's funny, because when you talk and when one reads about time travel from the scientific perspective as you're looking at, and then you think about virtually every tradition that's ever walked on the earth except for the scientific tradition has oracles in which people look into the future, people look into the past. There is some kind of knowledge. And I don't know, I can't help but wonder whether there is some relationship between those things and the kind of work you're doing now will help us to understand phenomena that many of us say is just fantasy.
It's possible. I mean, one thing I've learned from doing science is that we know very, very little. And in fact, in some bizarre sense, since there's more and more and more and more information out there than there ever was before, the actual fraction of things that we do know is getting less and less and less, even as we acquire more and more knowledge. So I would be the last person to sneer at weird, bizarre things happening, including many things that I have no explanation for.
Seth Lloyd is speaking tonight at the James A. Little Theater on the subject, Is Time Travel Possible? Testing the Grandfather Paradox. It's a free event sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. For more information, you can go to santafe.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.